From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Now there's a sound from film history. Godzilla, hundreds of feet tall, stomping, roaring, swinging that tail. Maybe he's taking out Tokyo. Maybe he's battling another monster. He's always colossal. Godzilla was born in grim nuclear parable. Now he's back, out of Hollywood this time, not Japan. This hour, On Point, the rise and return of Godzilla. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you know Godzilla's history? And what's the dark terror the King of Monsters might embody today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from San Francisco, is August Ragone, an expert on Japanese pop culture. He may be the world's top Godzilla historian. He's authored over 150 movie subtitle scripts written for Japanese Fantasy Film Journal, Video Watchdog, and Famous Monsters of Filmland. He blogs at The Good, the Bad, and Godzilla. Author of Eiji Tsubaraya, Master of Monsters, just out in paperback. August Ragone, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Also with us from Dallas, Texas, is William Tsutsui, outgoing dean of the College of Humanities and Sciences at Southern Methodist University, incoming president of Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas, an expert on modern Japanese business and economic history. Also a Godzilla superfan. He's author of Godzilla on My Mind, 50 Years of the King of Monsters, and co-editor of In Godzilla's Footsteps, Japanese Pop Culture Icons on the Global Stage. William Tsutsui, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's hear just a little bit from the trailer of the new movie Godzilla coming out in just about a week, directed by Gareth Edwards. Cast includes Bryan Cranston, Ken Watanabe, Elizabeth Olsen.
The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in our control. And not the other way around.
I know many of you have family and loved ones. And that you want to help them. Well, this is your chance.
From the trailer of the new Godzilla, roll the tape back now 60 years, 1954, from its original, at least American version. Here's a cut from that version, Godzilla 1954, starring Raymond Burr. Quite a grim film focused on the human toll of the monster's destruction, featured obvious allusions to nuclear devastation.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world. There were once many people here who could have told of what they saw. Now there are only a few.
We hear there the sound of the American early American version of the 1954 Godzilla. August Ragone, have you seen the new film yet? What are you hearing about what's coming? What are you hoping for? What are you expecting?
Well, actually, I'm going to be going to press screening here in San Francisco on Monday. So I haven't seen it yet, but everything that I've heard so far seems pretty positive that they're sticking to the core elements that made the original film a hit.
And what are those core elements? If this one scores in your book, if it's true to those deep, interestingly resounding roots, where would it head? What would it have to include?
Well, definitely would have to include the nuclear origins of the creature, and specifically, they're talking about having a flashback that's set in the 1950s, and does have allusions to the atomic testing at Bikini Atoll.
Atomic testing years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, atomic testing that rained a radioactive fallout on Japanese fishermen on the Lucky Dragon 5. All of Japan knew that radioactivity was still killing fellow Japanese.
Right, exactly. And that's why it's still relevant today, because we've recently had the Fukushima disaster. And for many years, especially in the 70s and 80s, Godzilla was not really relevant anymore. A lot of people didn't think he was relevant. Of course, then you had Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and that just sort of brought back the specter of Godzilla. And that's why he returned in the mid-80s and throughout the 90s in feature films out of Japan.
William Tsutsui, can you take us back to your early years and when you first saw Godzilla? What was the setting? How did you respond as a very young guy?
You know, I was 7 or 8 years old, and I was growing up in Central Texas, and I remember lying on the shag carpeting in my parents' bedroom, watching the big old Sylvania TV set, and it was the Creature Double Feature from KHOU in Houston on a Saturday afternoon, and I saw Godzilla for the first time, dragging his big scaly feet through Tokyo, making the buildings crumble and the chemical plants explode, and I thought, isn't that great? I want to be like that monster. And from that time, I really loved Godzilla. And growing up Japanese-American in Bryan, Texas, where there were two Japanese-American families, Godzilla really became part of my ethnic identity as well. Godzilla was something Japanese that all the other kids in my school recognized and thought was cool.
Did Americans get the meaning of Godzilla in those days compared to how Japan and the Japanese got it, William?
You know, everyone makes their own meaning out of a media product. And so I think American audiences got something different from it than Japanese audiences did. Obviously, in the mid-1950s, if we were watching the original Godzilla film, the themes of defeat in World War II, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Lucky Dragon incident, those were very close to the forefront of your mind. But in Texas in the 1970s, you were watching the movies because they were fun and entertaining, and because, a big monster walking through a city was just plain cool.
August, take us back to the origins of this film. I mean, the word itself, of course, in English, it's Godzilla. In Japanese, it's Gojira, a kind of mashup of the words for gorilla and whale. Who came up with the idea? What was the context? What brought it to the Japanese screen?
Well, there was a producer named Tomoyuki Tanaka, a young director at Toho Studios, and he had been given the job of going over to Indonesia to work out a film co-production between Toho Studios, the company he worked for that eventually produced Godzilla, and an Indonesian film studio. It was to reconcile World War II. Unfortunately, the Indonesian government decided that it wasn't the time. It was too soon. So they canceled all the visas for the filmmakers and the actors, and the producer got on the plane thinking about how am I going to save my job, and as he flew over back to Tokyo, dreamed up an idea of a monster movie. He had seen in a trade magazine an ad for Warner Brothers' film The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms with special effects by Ray Harryhausen, which had been the biggest moneymaker in 3 years for Warners, besides House of Wax with Vincent Price. And seeing that ad, he just started elaborating on that and thinking about the Lucky Dragon incident. And when he landed, he had concocted this whole idea and presented it to the director of production, Iwao Mori. And he actually went for it. And that's how the film just started from that point on.
Did The Beast from 20 Fathoms, the American film that he had seen that maybe inspired him here, did it have a nuclear thread in the heart of that story, the beast that came up from the bottom of the sea?
Yes, it actually did. It's, atomic testing in the Arctic, dislodges this monster who's been frozen in ice, and then it attacks New York eventually. But no one at Toho had seen the film. They had just seen the trade ads. The film came out in the United States in 1953, and in the spring of 54 is when Tomoyuki Tanaka had to sweat this idea out on his way home. And the film was not released in Japan until a month after Godzilla.
Godzilla in the U.S., it came out here before it came out even there. What was the reception in Japan, where many people would have had friends, relatives, would have known people who died in those atomic bombs, and then even more recent in the Lucky Dragon incident?
Right. It was a crisis that was at the forefront. That's pretty much, filmmaking in general, in terms of, a commercial film, Hollywood film. They always base something on recent events that the public is still interested in. So they, you know, intertwine the story of this monster coming out of the ocean with, you know, the Fukushima, not the Fukushima, rather, but the lucky dragon, the Fukuyu Ryumaru. So it was sort of, you know, just a confluence of events that made Godzilla happen in 54. If they had come up with the idea at any other time, it probably wouldn't have happened.
But I mean, you can imagine Japanese saying, this is horrifying. You're going to put the nuclear tragedy, nuclear destruction back in our face via this monster? We had enough, thank you.
Well, it was sort of an exorcism, in a way. So people were able to work that out cathartically.
In Gojira, or Godzilla, as it was called in the United States, August Ragone, please stand by in San Francisco. William Tsutsui in Dallas, Texas. Here's a movie music from the 1954 Godzilla. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise and return, again, of Godzilla, the Japanese movie monster conceived in the nuclear wreckage of World War II, now headed back again to the big screen. Here's a little bit in the Japanese. The film, American movie, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, was adapted with some new footage from 1954's Japanese film, Gojira. In this scene from Gojira, a horrified reporter in Japanese describes what he sees, saying, Godzilla is leaving behind a sea of flame. Godzilla striding across Tokyo, Raymond Burr was brought in, playing a reporter named Steve Martin in the American version. Lots of new footage in that version. Here's Raymond Burr talking as the monster rises out of the bay.
Here in Tokyo, time has been turned back 2 million years. This is my report as it happens. A prehistoric monster the Japanese call Godzilla has just walked out of Tokyo Bay. He's as tall as a 30-story building.
And here from the new Godzilla, out a week from today.
In 1954, we awakened something.
Well, there's nuclear tests in the Pacific. Not tests.
They were trying to kill it.
No idea what's coming.
Can you kill it?
From the new Godzilla. William Tsutsui is with us, author of Godzilla on My Mind and editor of In Godzilla's Footsteps, Japanese pop culture icons on the global stage. August Ragone is with us, author of Eiji Tsubaraya, Master of Monsters, has spent, well, a lot of time in Japanese culture, pop culture, and in the realm of Godzilla. He joins us from San Francisco. August, in the new film, it seems to arise from some nuclear disaster on the Japanese front. Before it's over, we can see from the trailers, it's in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge is in trouble, and there's a lot tumbling down, August.
Yes, absolutely. And ironically enough, as a San Franciscan, they filmed most of all the San Francisco footage in, I believe it was in Canada. So
Everything is filmed somewhere these days. But yes. We heard Ken Watanabe there in that little bit from the trailer. In 1954, we awakened something. What was the something that was supposedly in the first film? How did it describe what was awakened, August?
Well, in the original film there is a supposition by Dr. Yamane, who's the paleontologist, one of the main characters in the film. And he supposes that these Godzilla-type species of dinosaur were asleep in a deep pocket in the Pacific, and that the H-bomb tests had irritated them to come out or disturb their natural habitat. So that's why they came up and started, sinking fishing ships and then heading into Tokyo.
And that was to represent, William, how have you come to read it over the years? What that monster swimming on to Tokyo, coming up out of Tokyo Bay, representing what?
You know, what Godzilla represents changes significantly over time. Obviously, in the 1950s, the nuclear theme was extraordinarily strong. But come the 1960s and 1970s, the Godzilla series, they're movies for kids, and they're meant to be enjoyable. They still take on some serious themes in society, things like corruption in government, commercialism in society, even topics like school bullying. But generally, they don't touch on the more serious issues of the day. Come the 80s and 90s, there is a desire on the part of the filmmakers to return to sort of the original intent of having more serious movies. And yet, the nuclear issue just isn't resonating at that point.
And now, today, August, with all of the Fukushima backdrop to the new Godzilla, do you think it will have that full nuclear resonance again?
Oh, that's absolutely what's going on here in this film. And there is, you know, there are some direct and not very subtle things happening with a nuclear power plant in Japan at the start of the film.
And before you know it, Godzilla is back up and in gear. Here's, again, from the trailer, here's a very angry Bryan Cranston. He plays a nuclear engineer. Ken Watanabe, also a scientist in this film. Here's Bryan Cranston in the new Godzilla.
You are not fooling anybody when you say that what happened was a natural disaster.
You're lying.
It was not an earthquake. It wasn't a typhoon.
Because what's really happening is that you're hiding something out there. And it is going to send us back to the Stone Age.
$160 million version of Godzilla headed at us now. Gareth Edwards, the director, just 38 years old, has made just one feature film before. Low-budget 2010 film called Monsters. Little-known screenwriter is Max Borenstein. Max Borenstein, William Tsutsui, says that Godzilla is the sum of our fears, represents that which is beyond our control. Do you buy that, William?
You know, I think that's a very viable way to look at Godzilla, and especially if you want to make sort of a Godzilla as sort of the conscience for modern society, as Mother Nature's revenge, if you will, about a modern society that has forgotten the connection with the natural world. And I think that's consistent with the history of the series and has the makings for a good film.
The conscience of modern society, what does that mean, August, when he's tearing up Tokyo? How is that a conscience?
Well, there's sort of the, in terms of the cathartic, element of Godzilla and his violent destruction of urban areas, is just pretty much part of part and parcel of Godzilla's manifestation as revenge on man. And in the Japanese version of the film, the original, Godzilla is also sort of seen as, well, Ishiro Honda, the director, put it, that he was the embodiment or the incarnation of war itself, and how this creature represented not only that, but also the possible end of mankind. To viewers watching the film, sometimes some of their anxieties can be worked out. Certainly when I was a kid watching these films, you know, you just waited for the city destruction scenes. And if the film didn't was set on an island, let's say, we're a little disappointed at the time.
So when the Japanese were watching this in 1954, I'm sure they took many lessons from it. I mean, it's broad enough, you can take what you like. But was there the thought,
right,
we shouldn't have turned to war, or the Americans shouldn't have used nuclear weapons, or they shouldn't be testing nuclear weapons in the Pacific where our fishermen are?
Well, I'm sure that, you know, William will have a definite strong opinion on this. You know, I pretty much think that knowing the history, that audiences kind of worked out things that they, in this watching this film, that they couldn't say publicly or they didn't really want to say to their friends. Not everybody was on board with the war in Japan. And certainly the public, basically had a gun to their head, proverbially. So, you know, there is something to that in terms of, the beast and war.
What about the psychological reception of this film and the articulated reception of it, William Tsutsui?
You know, I think it's important to keep in mind that this is in many ways a therapeutic film, that it allows the Japanese of the time to work through some of their deepest fears, a return of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the threat of nuclear war, being caught in the middle between the superpowers in a very difficult time. But there's also a whole lot more going on here.
Talk to us about the whole lot more. What did you see in there?
You know, it's really – there's a very nationalistic theme in the original movie there's a very – also very anti-American theme in the 1954 film. Clearly, the monster is caused by American H-bomb testing, just as Japan's trauma in 1945 was caused by American science in the form of the atomic bombs. In the movies, Japan really overcomes the monster independently, without help from the outside world, because of an innovation of Japanese science that is used to save humanity rather than, in the case of the product of the Manhattan Project, to kill people.
Let's go to our listeners. Paul in Atlanta, Georgia. Paul, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just want to say I just love this subject. I've always been a big fan of monster movies and the whole genre itself. I believe that, you know, through the years, Godzilla's even been written up in songs, the Blue Oyster Cult songs about him, too, in case people forgot. And it points out the follies of men, and that's actually a line from the song. You know, all the way through the 90s, and even in the 90s, when they redid it in the 90s, I don't know how much it could be rehashed, but they made it kind of an asexual being where it was actually reproducing by itself. At least it gave that impression to me. That's what it looks like to me.
Anything's possible.
I'm sorry?
Anything's possible with a lizard from the deep.
That is true. That is true. And I just want to say, it looks to me, through looking at the trailers for this one, that it really goes back to what the original meaning of Godzilla was from the 1950s. It seems like he's a very upset little monster right now.
Yeah, he's very upset. I'll give you a little side-by-side, Paul, there in Atlanta. I've got the roar from the original and the roar from the upcoming, the new movie. Here's the original iconic Godzilla roar from 1954. Of course, that Godzilla was created by created by dragging a resin-coated glove across the strings of a double bass. Stomping, and then the roar, and 2014, here's the newly redesigned roar from the upcoming movie. August Ragone sounds like they might almost hit a piece of the same note, but with a lot more reverb now.
Yes, you know, actually, I think I saw something that was talking about how they did that, and they did take a sample of the original, and they completely reworked it. I think they did, you know, over 100 different versions until they found that sweet spot, the one that they could all agree upon.
There's been all kinds of stomping and screaming over the years. Here's Godzilla from 1985 terrorizing a crowd. And they're on the run. We're looking at the rise and return of Godzilla. Robin in Charleston, South Carolina. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I think I first remember Godzilla when I was a child in the 70s. There was a show that came on the afternoon called Ultraman, and it took place in Japan, and it was a scientist or an engineer, and when the bad creatures came, he would go outside, stick his hand up in the air with what looked like a microphone, and he would turn into this giant, like, aluminum-clad, you know, figure to fight off, you know, evil. And I believe Godzilla was one of his opponents.
William Tsutsui, what about it? Godzilla through the years, there with Ultraman.
You actually have one of the greatest experts on Ultraman in the world sitting in a microphone talking to you. August is the real expert.
Oh, great. August, please, Ultraman us.
Yes, well, Ultraman was created by Eiji Tsuburaya, the subject of my book.
Yes.
And that was a series that came out in 1966. It was sort of an extension of the monster movies that they had been successfully producing at Toho Studios for a number of years. It just completely blew away audiences in Japan. There was a series that came on before it that led into it called Ultra Q, and that was a black and white series that served to be like, you know, a series of mini Toho monster movies. And then they segued into this all-color series, Ultraman, and that became such a huge cultural and social phenomenon that they're still making Ultraman to this day.
And what did Godzilla mean in that series? Was it the same as in 1954? Was he transformed in some way? What?
Well, with Ultraman, since Eiji Tsuburaya was the producer of it, he was able to take what he wanted, basically, from his own stock, his own prop room, rather, at Toho Studios. So they thought it would be really funny because Ultraman was such a big hit that the staff would, you know, argue, yeah, hey, you know, could Ultraman beat Godzilla? You know, one of those kind of arguments among the staff, like, yeah, that'd be great. So they actually took one of the Godzilla suits and redressed it. And then they had this whole episode where this monster is coming out of a lake, and it's Godzilla with a big frill on his neck, like a frilled lizard. And at the end, Ultraman fights him, and it's nothing. It's not even in the script of the episode, but Ultraman tears off this frill, and then suddenly you have a couple of minutes of a Godzilla versus Ultraman fight.
Was it the original kind of big rubber suit that they had Japanese, poor sweating Japanese actors inside in the original movie?
Well, they used one of the suits. They had used the suit that the series was made in 66, so it was one of the suits from that time period, which were much lighter than the original suit.
Thank heavens.
Ultraman, I'm sorry.
You know, the stories of the original suit were sort of mind-boggling. They could only spend a minute or two in there before they practically sweated to death.
Well, yeah, they would actually pass out. They couldn't stand, you know, being in that suit because of a number of conditions that were going on. Number one, the suit weighed 220 pounds, had no ventilation, or very, very, very little ventilation. So you just say it's no ventilation. They were filming at the height of the summer. Japanese sound stages are not ventilated well or air conditioned at that time. I don't think they still are in a way. And then also that they had to use really intense lighting back then for the film stocks to be able to read, read register on film, rather. And so all those elements, you know, combined would mean it would be 110 degrees in the studio. So those guys would pass out after about a minute in the suit.
Suitmation, it was called back in the day, 1954, the original Godzilla. Now Godzilla's back, and you better believe there's plenty of CGI in the new $160 million version. August Ragone, please stand by in San Francisco. It's great to have you there. I hope your city remains intact through the remainder of this hour. William Tsutsui in Dallas, Texas. It's great to have you with us. A little new Godzilla soundtrack here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about the rise and return of Godzilla this hour, the Japanese movie monster conceived in the nuclear wreckage of World War II, now headed back again to the big screen, with August Ragone, author of Eiji Tsuburaya, Master of Monsters, and William Tsutsui, author of Godzilla on My Mind, editor of In Godzilla's Footsteps. You can join us as well. What are you hoping for in the new film? What do you want from Godzilla now? Do you just like saying the word Godzilla? There have been 30-plus returns of Godzilla. Here, returning to its darker, scarier roots after some pretty silly time. In 1984 is The Return of Godzilla, released in America as Godzilla 1985. Added scenes starring Raymond Burr, who also starred in the original, Americanized version of the original Godzilla Gojira.
30 years ago, he thought it was over.
Troops, aircraft, rockets, they were all used before.
Now, your favorite fire-breathing monster is back, like you've never seen him before. The legend is reborn in the all-new Godzilla 1985. starring Raymond Burr, Godzilla, 1985.
All kinds of twists and turns along the way. The pattern in Godzilla movies of Godzilla facing off against other monsters established pretty early. Here in 1964's Mothra versus Godzilla, the big guy battles the giant moth, Mothra, who had already appeared in its own movie, as onlookers provide commentary here.
What is that yellow powder?
It is the last weapon he has.
Oh, it's some kind of poison then.
And then it gets really goofy. 1969, the Godzilla franchise reimagined toward children in All Monsters Attack, released later in the U.S. as Godzilla's Revenge. Godzilla loses most of his menace. The movie tells the story of a bullied young child who magically transports himself to Monster Island. He learns courage from Godzilla and Godzilla's young son, Minilla.
Oh, hello.
What are you doing, huh?
Just feeling lonesome because I got no friends.
We're both alive.
Why'd you come back, huh?
I like it here. And I also want to see your daddy, Godzilla.
I'll introduce you, if we can find him.
William Satui, how did Godzilla become almost Barney-sounding?
You know, it's partly a result of the Japanese film market in the 60s and 70s. TV was killing Japanese movies. And the one dependable audience that Japanese studios had left were young children. And so the producers really made films geared for their audience. And they were just fun, goofy movies. You still laugh at them today.
I mean, we've got listeners who remember those. Jane writes to us, oh, you know, OMG, Godzilla versus the Sea Monster has a great volleyball match. Okay, August, how do you take the fangs that far out of Godzilla? What, the children's market was driving it? And it does look like, it sounded like practically a Barney run up there.
Well, starting in the early 1960s, Japanese film audiences started dropping off because of television, as William said. And so they were looking to find new audiences. So they went from sort of a general audience to targeting towards teenagers. So by the time they did Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster in 1966, they were fully hitting what they considered the youth market, the same kind of kids in America that would go see, you know, Beach Blanket Bingo, you know, and all those beach pictures with Frankie Avalon. So they were kind of aiming for that market, and it got narrower and narrower towards the end of the 60s, and then they started making these films specifically in a kiddie matinee package that was also put together with a bunch of different cartoons and short subjects. And so at that point in the 70s, it was just right straight to the kids. And the strange schism of those films to a lot of Americans is the fact that they're highly violent, because that was sort of permissible at the time until the Japanese PTA came along a little later. But they would be, you know, so it's hard for some people to wrap their brains around the fact that these movies seem so silly that were made in the 70s and could be just so violent. They just can't fathom that they were made for kids. They were some writers, I think it was a Gregory Ferret wrote in Cinefantastic magazine about 1973's Godzilla versus Megalon. He said, I can't believe that, you know, Toho is making these kind of movies. Do people take these seriously anymore?
Very
not knowing that they were marketed for kids.
Right. Very cheery sounding, but very violent at the same time. Still a little Some of All Fears action going on underneath there. Deborah in Boston. Deborah, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hi.
I was very lucky to see the original Godzilla just about a month ago in Los Angeles at the TCM Film Festival, where they presented the premiere of the restored 1954 Godzilla with Raymond Burr removed and all the original material put back. I think it was like 98 minutes that were missing.
Wow, Japanese and, style then, more like the true original Gojira.
Yes, it was the original Gojira. And what was wonderful was that, yes, you got to see the anti-war message and the anti-nuclear message, but the black humor as well, which was a lovely surprise. And they had, introducing the film, Gareth Edwards, the new director of the new Godzilla,
wow,
and film historian Eddie von Mueller. And as much as Gareth Edwards is very excited about his new, what do you want to say, CGI Godzilla, yep, he was very respectful of the old Godzilla and said, you know, I can't compete. I can't compete with the original.
That's pretty incredible after all these years. Did it take you to that kind of heart of nuclear darkness,
yes,
fear and anger, Deborah?
Yes. And with, you know, all respect to Perry Mason, it was really good to have him gone, because it's a completely different film. And I was born in 53, so I grew up with all the Godzilla movies, and I enjoyed very much watching Godzilla teach his son to spit fire and all of that. And I loved watching Godzilla defeat Rodan and Mothra and save Tokyo and all of that. But in this film, this is a much different film, a much stronger film. The anti-war message was very strong, the anti-nuclear message, and the black humor. And you laugh and you feel a little guilty. But at the same time, you still laugh and you realize what an incredibly smart film it is.
Deborah, you bring it right up to date for us, and I appreciate that. William Tsutsui, what about the American version back then with everything that was removed? Did Americans even see the full nuclear, anti-nuclear, anti-war message of the original Gojira, Godzilla?
No, it was very much sanitized for American audiences. Really, the political edge was taken out, and anything that could be seen as critical of America or which was too clear a reference to the Japan's wartime experience was expunged. Whether or not this was a real political move by the American distributors or not is really unclear. They were just trying to make a movie that sold and appealed to American audiences. But if you watch the two side-by-side today, that Japanese original really is a much more powerful film.
August, you know these two countries and cultures very well. When you think about how Japanese hold Godzilla in their minds, and of course there are many ways, but by and large, and then how Americans hold Godzilla in their minds, are they similar or different ways of grasping the great monster?
Well, there are similarities between the two cultures in addressing the character of Godzilla. Although the Japanese Godzilla is sort of passé now, and he has been passé for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Younger children seem gravitated more towards the Power Rangers style shows, which are produced in Japan. And I think Godzilla is more prevalent in pop culture in the United States than in Japan. At least today, we have all these things labeled Zilla, Bridezilla, and so on. So Godzilla still lingers in the American popular cultural consciousness, but not so much in Japan. He's sort of the realm of guys like me who are, in their 40s and 50s that are waxing nostalgic about these movies.
Does it come to us in the literature of Godzilla, maybe your own works, August or William? Who came up with Godzilla as the American version of Gojira?
I wish there was a good story to go behind that and that this was, something very conscious. The reality was that as Japanese was transliterated into English in the 1950s, mm-hmm. the J-I became a D-Z-I, and R's and L's are very similar in Japanese.
Yes.
It's not clearly distinguished sounds. So it was really transliterated literally from Gojira to Godzilla.
And there you have it, and all the Zillas mm-hmm. that came behind. Harry in Burlington, right. Vermont. Harry, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a great topic. Really hilarious stuff, actually. I grew up, I was born in 64, but actually I'm a cover artist and a cartoonist for The New Yorker. Uh-huh. And years ago I did a cover that featured King Kong sort of spraying all the New Yorkers with a huge super soaker.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was when the Peter Jackson the remake came out. But this just recently, I submitted another one that had Godzilla kind of wreaking havoc again in the city. But all the New Yorkers were just sort of taking selfies with Godzilla in the back. But it's funny for me. At least when I grew up and all my buddies who were in their late 40s and early 50s, Godzilla really represented our parents, Godzilla represented us, and the destruction was kind of our rebelling against, authority figures. So every time Godzilla or, whoever it was, when Mothra, Ghidra, Rodan, they were destroying things, that was very cathartic for us. And I just wondered if your guests had any comments on that.
Yeah, Harry, we look forward to your Godzilla plus selfies in New York. that sounds great. What about it? you know, Godzilla as symbol of teenage rebellion or Godzilla as symbol of nature's revenge against the depredations of man? Where do you go with it, William?
You know, I think what's one of the wonderful things about Godzilla and why Godzilla's had so much staying power in the American cultural imagination is because Godzilla is a guy in a rubber suit. It invites you to imagine yourself as the monster because there is a human-to-human connection with the monster. And that's one of the things that's been lost, I think, in the American productions and in more recent Japanese ones where the emphasis has been on high-quality CGI. I think many of us grew up thinking we were Godzilla and wanting to be Godzilla.
Harry, you're not alone in that, I guess. Got pretty bad at certain points in 1998. The American Godzilla movie was almost universally panned, especially by Godzilla fans. The movie transferred the action from Tokyo to New York, gave the monster a redesign, robbed it of a lot of its majesty and terror. In this scene, the heroes try to outrun the monster in a taxi cab.
1057th Street across town and cut up the west side.
No, what are you crazy? Take the FDR!
Please, the FDR in the rain?
Be a map.
Sounds pretty dorky. August here, one of our listeners, JP, says, how are they going to top the 90s Hollywood version? Matthew Broderick, that French dude from Professional, Green Day and Puff Daddy, back when he was still Puff Daddy, can't top that, LOL. There's sort of no end to the depths Godzilla could go to here as well.
Well, you know, Gareth Edwards could direct a film in his sleep, and it would be better than the 1998 film.
I wonder about Pacific Rim, you know, which came out not so long ago. Guillermo del Toro got a pretty great reception. If somehow that was building the ramp up to the big monster movie, Pacific Rim gave it some cred. It was a pretty good film.
Yeah, well, you know, del Toro was really seasoned in this genre. He was born and raised in Mexico, and there was a lot more Japanese programming besides the Godzilla movies and what we got in the States. And as the caller mentioned earlier, Ultraman, they had all these different series and these animated robot series from Japan, these super robots. So all those things were very influential to Del Toro in making Pacific Rim. And living in San Francisco, I grew up with all the same stuff that he did. So when I saw that film, when I wrote a review on the film, I said, Pacific Rim, thank you, Del Toro. You made a grown man cry.
Stephen in Cushing, Oklahoma. Stephen, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
My generation grew up watching Godzilla. You know, we grew up in, you know, very racist Oklahoma, and we're Native American people. And Godzilla gave us the courage to stand up and fight.
So Godzilla, Stephen, are you Native American, and Godzilla was a symbol of drawing on your own powers or something?
Yeah, to fight, never give up.
Wow. Was it kids sitting around watching afternoon television?
All my young generation, nieces and nephews, and they're all gone now.
What did your tribal elders think of your Godzilla fascination?
They didn't mind because, you know, we grew up with stories, you know, ancient legends, and he was a symbol of resistance, you know, like Crazy Horse, but, you know, a tangible symbol we could see, you know. We have legends similar of creatures like him, great creatures.
Fascinating. A Native American boyhood in Oklahoma and Godzilla standing for, strength and resistance. William Tsutsui, you were growing up as a Japanese boy in Texas. Can you relate to that?
Who knew the big guy would be an ethnic hero around the world? That's really a great story.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
August, I guess everybody can tap into where they want to direct that fierceness, how they want to see that rage, strength.
Right. Yeah, it really has, as William stated earlier, you know, everybody brings their own psyche to Godzilla, or implants, transposes their psyche into Godzilla. So Godzilla becomes, as Alex Cox said, the 1998 BBC documentary, that, you know, Godzilla becomes anything you want it to be, depending on where you are and who you are.
The monster.
So it's universal in that regard.
Yeah, even there into Native American Oklahoma as a symbol of strength, as a creature of nature's power. And now, we're a week from a new one coming out. August Fragoni, it's been terrific to have you with us to look back on the history of Godzilla.
Thank you
very much. Yeah, I really appreciate it. I hope we have a Godzilla coming out here that you can enjoy and sign off on. If it does, it'll have that Japanese weight to it that we want to see. Author of Eiji Tsubaraya, August Fragoni, and William Tsutsui, author of Godzilla on My Mind, 50 Years of the King of Monsters. Of course, it's now 60 years. William Tsutsui, thank you very much for joining us from Dallas today.
It was good fun. Keep watching out for the big guy.
Yeah, the big guy coming to American shores in the new movie a week from today. We'll go out with the Blue Oyster Cult's 1977 Godzilla. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.